Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I don't know about you, but I am sick and tired of hearing the name Donald Trump. Try him and fry him and be done with him. He is a loathsome and unfortunately contagious malignant festering the USA. He has blatantly announced his empirical plans for his possibly renewed presidency of the USA. The plans are rife with Hitlerism and his intent to be America's first full-fledged dictator, an absolute demand, not simply an aspiration. He warned us when he was president about his fatuously fascist demands, and even while at trial for attempting to more or less recapture the White House by mob assault and fatuous denial of being voted out of office. And even while at trial, he acts as blatant as though he thinks nothing and nobody can stop him and his fatuously fascist demands, which is the gist of his current candidacy. Despite all the confusing and contrary minutiae, Trump has been quite accurately described as a glowering Gorgon, quote unquote, which aptly captures his contemptible conceit as well as his conceitful contempt for everyone but himself. He has been described as, quote, a man of sociopathic tendencies, unquote, who is incapable of thinking in even moral terms, and that's another quote. Of course, that is up to a jury to decide, and also for voters. Even when at trial for his despotic tendencies, he yet blatantly plots to regain power, demanding he be recognized as America, with a K, America's Der Führer, half a year away from the 2024 presidential election. He refuses to say he would accept losing the 2026 election, repeating his lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him, obviously hinting at fomenting violent reactionary reprisal if he is once more a loser. And now, from the late Arthur Honeyman, writer, poet, and immortal spastic, someone whom Trump might wish to exterminate as a human defective if he were elected as tyrant. Matrix of a social spastic. With a little intro, Arthur Honeyman, one of the most famous and notorious Oregonians in the state's history, would be 84 on May 10th. He spent his life fighting for the rights and recognition of people who are considered physically handicapped. He was a teacher, poet, and writer, author of the award-winning Salmon is Cart and several other books, essays, and collections of his poetry. He was co-founder of Wheel Press and had a Bachelor of Science degree in history and a Master of Arts in English, both from Portland State University. He died in 2008 at the age of 68. Matrix of a Social Spastic, which he wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle. Cerebral palsy is perhaps one of the worst afflictions that can strike a person. Because I am a victim of this affliction, much of what I am writing centers around me. What I write is what I have observed from self-experience and from others who are also handicapped by cerebral palsy. I write not only about the physical problems of the cerebral palsied, but also show psychological problems a cerebral palsy victim suffers. I do not intend a long and technical analysis, which I myself do not understand and cannot even hope to explain. I will satisfy myself by barely touching the definition and the causes of this affliction. Because cerebral palsy is not a disease, and because most cerebral palsy victims have internal organs which function normally, the average CP has no real health problems. For instance, I am rarely sick enough to stay in bed. Most of the literature which is written on cerebral palsy concerns the care of children stricken by it. I will try to restrict myself to the problems of the teenager and the young adult. Cerebral palsy is also known as Little's disease. Dr. Little was probably the pioneer in medical interest in what is commonly known as palsy or spasticity. The number of victims of cerebral palsy is estimated at various numbers. One book says there are 400,000 CPs in the United States, while another says there are 550,000. About 200,000 of these are children, and 350,000 are adults. It has also been estimated that every 53 minutes, a child is born with cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is, of course, due to brain damage, probably to the medulla and cerebellum. Some injuries are prenatal, others perinatal, and others postnatal. Prenatal damage is generally due to two types of injuries, either hereditary or congenital. Tuberous sclerosis and Tay-Sachs disease fall under the first cause. Anoxia, maternal infections, metabolic disease, and Rh factors fall under the latter cause. Cerebral palsy due to perinatal during birth is generally caused by mechanical damage such as trauma. This includes squeezing the brain too hard during labor or by forceps in the process of delivery. Also, there are prematurities with low vitamin K level and anoxia. Perinatal also includes asphyxia, which is due to respiratory obstructions during labor. Postnatal refers to brain damage after birth. Such injuries as skull fractures and wounds come under trauma, which is usually brought about by falling on the head or by similar accidents. The second is infectious, which is caused by meningitis and encephalitis. Third is vascular, by hemorrhage, thrombosis, and embolus. Anoxia is caused by carbon dioxide and or monoxide poisoning and neoplasms. There are several types of cerebral palsy. There is spasticity, which is usually characterized by short jerks or rhythmic spasms. Aphytosis refers to a type of cerebral palsy in which the victim makes twisting, worm-like motions. This is the type I suffer. More often than not, spasticity and aphytosis are intermingled. The third type is ataxia, which refers to slow, stiff, almost paralyzed movements in which walking is difficult. There is a sense of anti-gravity, and the victim often has a reduced sense of balance. Other characteristics are flabby and loose muscles. The fourth is rigidity, which is characterized by stiffness. The victim finds it difficult to move limbs, and motion resembles an unoiled robot. Tremor is the fifth type and is characterized by involuntary rhythmic movements. In some victims, not only their muscles be uncoordinated, but the senses may be haywire. Some CPs are disturbed by spasticity in their eyes, which may receive double vision, reducing the person's sense of balance. As with all CPs, disturbances like these are caused by misdelivery of the message to the brain through the nerves, resulting in inaccurate perception of the eyes. An example of an athetoid's problem of muscles is when an athetoid reaches for an object. Nerve cells misdirect the hands so that the object is not reached or knocked over. Also, in many CPs, hearing may be defective. The result is that the CP may appear to be stupid or uninterested. For centuries, the CP was regarded as an idiot because of spasticity, drooling, speech, and other convulsive traits. CPs can be paraplegics, which refers to two limbs, quadriplegics, four limbs, or hemiplegics, one side of the body. Because athetosis is the affliction I suffer, I am going to concentrate on it. Also, I believe it to be the most terrible of the various types of cerebral palsy. The reason is this. Many victims of athetosis are not able to write or feed themselves, display annoying and unpleasant actions, such as facial contortions and drooling, and exhibit worm-like movements. This naturally means the CP is not readily accepted by society. Obviously, one can see what this would do to the average CP's social standing. The athetoid can be extremely strong physically and still not be able to attend to the simplest things which the average person takes for granted. I can lift myself up by using an overhead bar so that my feet don't touch the ground, but I cannot hold on to a glass of water, not because I am not strong enough, but rather because I am uncoordinated and the glass shakes out of my grasp. The harder I try to do something, the more difficult it becomes. I become excited and tremble, which almost everyone does from fear or excitement, to a much greater than normal degree. I spasticate. One may ask, why not relax? Of course I should relax. I would be able to do all sorts of things. I would be able to speak better. But it is difficult for an athetoid to relax. It takes us rigorous and slow training and development of muscular control to relax. This depends partially on the severity of the affliction, partially on individual character, upbringing, background, and environment, and also on medical facilities, as well as psychological or psychiatric treatment. I believe the greatest overall problem which a CP, especially an athetoid, faces is the problem of being socially accepted. One cannot rightfully expect to be accepted on an equal basis by society unless he or she proves equal to it. This is true whether it is blacks, Jews, alcoholics, or CPs. On the other hand, society must give each the equal chance to prove equal, which it does only reluctantly and slowly. This means minority groups must work twice as hard or more to achieve acceptance. This is extremely difficult for a CP, particularly the athetoid, because of the inability to function as well or as fast as the average person. It is also difficult to make friends because of spasticity, drooling, unpleasant facial expressions, and speech defects. Victims of other afflictions such as polio, muscular dystrophy, muscular sclerosis, and so forth, do not always accept CPs to be on their own level. CPs must prove to be equal to them. I first discovered this while attending a school for crippled children. I was shocked and hurt, and I don't think I have ever quite recovered from this realization. A roommate at the school coined an interesting but unoriginal phrase, "The only good CP is a dead CP," quote unquote. This, in essence, expressed the feeling of almost all who did not suffer CP. Very few CPs marry, and very few have much of a home life. if any, after their parents die. It is a problem for the public to take care of those afflicted with CP. For years, the problem was taken care of by conveniently tucking CPs out of sight and putting them in a dark corner where they lethargically passed the time. The public is slowly arriving at an awareness that the CP is included in the human race. There are special schools, special homes, special associations for the CP. However, there is a tendency to confine CPs or all cripples into one little social group. The life expectancy of a CP is considerably less than an average person. This does not mean they die early because of physical degeneration, but rather from psychological attitude. This attitude is primarily from not being accepted in society on an equal basis and not being able to do what the average person can do. Education is crucial to the survival of CPs as well as all handicapped persons, even more than to non-handicapped. The individual who is both versatile and efficient takes priority in the job market, especially when jobs are scarce. It requires skill to become and remain employed, even in the best times. This is especially true now, when people everywhere are being laid off. So-called able-bodied unemployed workers can do hard labor or other physically oriented tasks. Not so with CPs or other handicapped, who find it difficult to be employed at any time. Education does not guarantee jobs, but it does help, especially disabled job seekers. During times of government cutbacks, we handicaps, and that's up in a quote, have to be resourceful just to stay alive without financial aid from agencies or organizations of some kind, public or private. I would have never have been employed without a decent education. Luckily, I was able to attend college. Both of my degrees, Bachelor of Science in History and MA in English, have not directly related to any position I've held, but they give me more credibility than no degree. Combined with my real-life experience, my academic education has given me the skills to create every job I have ever had. Throughout the ages, the CP has been treated more as an animal than as a person. In ancient Greece, for instance, CPs were thrown over cliffs to their deaths because of their uselessness, as were all physical cripples. During the Middle Ages, they were locked away in dark pits along with the mentally insane. During the Renaissance period, artists depicted them as creatures in their works. A carving from ancient Egypt was dug up of a person whose body was deformed in such a manner to indicate he suffered from cerebral palsy. It has not been until recently that CPs were allowed out into the streets and to intermingle in society. During the late 19th century, for example, CPs were confined to rooms and were more or less a thing nobody talked about. CPs are much better off than they have ever been, and the future looks brighter than the present. The promise that modern technology and medicine might come upon at least a partial cure has become more likely. More than that, the public is becoming more aware and understanding of the problems of cerebral palsy, which means CPs can hope for a more pleasant future. And that was Matrix of a Social Spastic by the late Arthur Honeyman, who died in 2008 at the age of 68. And now, from the Washington Post, by Brian Van Der Mark. The grim history of using troops against student protesters. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, and Republican Senators Tom Cotton, Arkansas, and Josh Hawley, Missouri, are among the conservative leaders suggesting that the National Guard might be needed to control campus protests across the country against Israel's war in Gaza. Such calls stir memories of the tragedy 54 years ago at Kent State University in northeastern Ohio. On May 1st, 1970, a Friday night, several hundred Kent State students poured out of downtown bars near closing time and began harassing motorists, smashing store windows, and spray painting buildings with anti-war slogans. Mayor Leroy Satrone, a conservative Democrat elected by Kent voters 6 months earlier on a Get Tough platform against long-haired students, and that's a quote, telephoned the governor's office the next day, saying that outside agitators were fomenting subversion and disorder in his town. The mayor asked that the National Guard be dispatched to Kent. University officials had a different plan. They preferred to deal with the situation by using university police with county sheriff's deputies as reinforcements and Ohio State Highway Patrol officers as a last resort, but they were not consulted. That Saturday night, student protesters against the Vietnam War put Kent State's ROTC building to the torch. University police and riot gear eventually drove off the protesters with tear gas. By then, Governor Jim Rhodes had acted on the mayor's request, and a short time later, a line of armored personnel carriers, jeeps, and trucks reached campus carrying several hundred Ohio National Guardsmen. The following afternoon, on May 3rd, Rhodes met in Kent with state and local officials. Rhodes was in the final year of his second four-year term. Barred by the state constitution from running again, he was seeking the Republican nomination for a U.S. Senate seat in a primary election just 48 hours away. Trailing in the polls, Rhodes had positioned himself as the candidate who would use, quote, all the force that was necessary, unquote, to end campus disturbances throughout the state. Though university officials were invited to the meeting, Rhodes brushed them off and effectively silenced the very authorities who best understood the students' tempers and attitudes. Instead, the governor defined the guard's mission as applying whatever force necessary to break up a protest on campus, quote unquote. When someone asked Rhodes to define a protest, he replied, two students walking together. That's a quote. At this point, reporters who had learned of the meeting entered the room. Rhodes grew theatrical. Pounding his fist on the conference table, he declared in an angry voice, we are going to put a stop to this, and we are going to eradicate the problem, and they're the worst types of people we harbor in America. The table-thumping performance only added fuel to the blaze of confrontation. As the meeting ended, Portage County Prosecutor Ron Kane, a blunt-speaking man who understood the mood in Kent as well as anyone, followed the governor into the men's room for a private talk. Away from reporters, Kane implored Rhodes to close the university while passions cooled. We're sitting on a keg of dynamite that could blow at any minute, the prosecutor warned, adding in saltier language that people were likely to get hurt. No, we mustn't do that, Rhodes replied. We must not knuckle under. As many as 3,000 students gathered the next morning, Monday, May 4th, on the university commons for a previously scheduled anti-war rally. The commander of National Guard forces on the scene, Assistant Adjutant General Robert Canterbury, decided to disperse the protesters. As Kane and others had feared, the presence of armed troops inflamed the students, what had been planned as a protest against the war became a protest of a different sort. It was not an anti-war rally, said a student. It was now a National Guard get the hell off our campus rally. Canterbury ordered 8 officers to lead 96 guardsmen to break up the crowd, roughly 1 guardsman for every 30 protesters. They received scant guidance. We had no understanding as to the amount of force we were supposed to use to accomplish that mission, remembered one of the troops. There had not been a briefing before we moved out to explain what to do and how to do it. Looking back, years later, another guardsman wondered, why would you put soldiers trained to kill on a university campus to serve a police function? Weary after a series of 12-hour shifts and having slept little the night before, the troops were in poor condition for the tense confrontation. The only thing I saw among the guys was fatigue and nerves, said one guard officer. Some of the guardsmen were teenagers. Some were inexperienced with their rifles. Most wore a gas mask and a helmet that made it difficult to hear commands. The reckless Canterbury also failed to warn protesters, as required by Ohio National Guard regulations for crowd control, that his men were armed and loaded with rifles containing high-velocity bullets that could kill at a range of 1,000 yards and at 200 yards could pierce a steel helmet and pass straight through a human head. Unaware of the risk, students advanced toward the nervous guardsmen, and at 12:24 p.m., several of the troops opened fire. 4 Kent State students were killed, and 9 were wounded, one of them paralyzed for life. This entirely avoidable tragedy had its bloody roots in the table-pounding performance of a politician angling for votes. Roads should be an object lesson for officials such as Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who have called for force to quell today's student protests over the war in Gaza. So far, campus demonstrations have been nuisances, even disruptions. Where there has been anti-Semitic harassment by protesters, the demonstrations have included reprehensible expressions of intolerance and hate. But they have not been violent, and violence should not be threatened in response. University officials, not state authorities, and armed troops possess the knowledge and insight best suited to dealing with these constitutionally protected expressions of dissent. The goal of university and college administrators should be to guarantee the safety of all students while fostering civil engagement over passionately held views. This is the lesson of Kent State University. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout continues as engineer of this program. Happy Mayflowers grown from April showers. A pleasant cliche. Excuse my vernal fatuosity.